And so we come to the second of the big two. The two big ethical issues that are at center stage in the morality crisis in America. We've looked at homosexuality several weeks ago, and today, abortion. The crisis surrounding abortion is both public and private. Now, it's the public or political debate that captures most of the attention, especially at an election time or in the case when the Supreme Court has a vacancy. And unfortunately, this public political debate overshadows the real personal crisis that is felt in homes all over our nation and our world. And it's this personal tragedy I want to acknowledge before I go any further in this message. You could probably guess where I'm going to end up in stating my position and this church's position on the topic of abortion. And I anticipate that hundreds of you who have lived through the terror of abortion may cringe, waiting to be pounced on for the choice that you've made. But I hope you perceive that doesn't happen. It's my sincere desire to be sensitive and to be graceful and ultimately, through this time, offer you an opportunity to heal. I can only imagine what you have gone through when you chose to abort pregnancy. The estimated 1.3 million abortions a year, and who knows if that's accurate, or the 46 million worldwide, there are numerous factors that have led to those abortions. Here's just a few. Pressure, including threats from outside influences, the father of the baby, the girl's parents, friends, etc. Pressures from social standards relating to career-minded women. Bad timing, too young in high school, aspirations of getting a college degree. Perceived shame or exposure to gossip, ridicule, being judged. Were she to carry the baby to term, especially prevalent among Christians. Financial issues, domestic violence issues, marital problems, medical reasons upon advice from a physician, fear of having to raise the child alone, date rape, rape by a stranger, incest, fear of abandonment, fear of the responsibilities of parenting, emotional immaturity, and codependency. These are only just a few. And my point, why list all of these factors? Well, someone I read said it this way. When abortion is framed as a selfish act by a self-possessed woman, it is a horribly cruel oversimplification of a complicated, horrific situation. Frederica Matthews Green said it very stunningly this way. No one wants an abortion as she wants an ice cream cone or a Porsche. She wants an abortion as an animal caught in a trap wants to gnaw off its own leg. So for those of you who are caught in that trap, perhaps as many as one out of every four in this room, I offer to you compassion. And for those of you who have yet to face this, I want to explore the ethical dilemma that hopefully you'll never have to face. What is an ethic on the issue of abortion that is commensurate with kingdom values? Or simply, what does God feel about abortion? And what should be our response? Now, I'm going to be upfront with you. There's no explicit teaching in the scriptures regarding abortion. No explicit verse or passage that addresses this issue the way it would be great if it was there. But there's plenty of corollary material, which we'll look at in just a moment. But even though the scriptures aren't explicit in teaching, the early church did do some significant teaching about it. In a document called the Didache, which is one of the earliest handbooks of Christian teaching. Matter of fact, the Didache came very close to be considered a part of the canon of Scripture. But in the Didache, this early handbook that was distributed among the early churches, there is this statement: do not kill a fetus by abortion or kill a newborn infant. Now, why did they have to add that teaching in this handbook? Well, it's because they had to deal with abortion as a rampant issue. Now, you might find that surprising because I think people commonly suppose that abortion is an invention of our modern technological medicine. Well, the fact is that it was well known in Greco-Roman culture of the first century. Plato's Republic made abortion or infanticide obligatory if the mother was over 40. The mother was over 40 and got pregnant, Plato said she should abort the child. Aristotle painted a picture of an ideal society in which abortion would be compulsory for families that exceeded a certain size. Aristotle. And so we don't just have a modern issue here. Abortion was prevalent, and the early church had to deal with it and construct in their early handbook how to deal with this issue. And they based it on some key scriptures like Matthew 5:21, where it says, "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment." It's pretty clear. It's pretty clear if you believe that abortion is murder, that God is against killing of all kinds. Of course, there are those who do not believe that abortion is murder, and stay with me for a few moments because we're going to come to that in a minute. Then there are a whole raft of other references. References that reference God's care for humanity, even pre-birth, like Genesis 1:27, where it tells us that God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. In Matthew 6:26, where Jesus said, "Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they?" And Psalm 139, verse 13, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, and I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." Now, what do we take from these passages of Scripture? These corollary passages that inform how God feels about life, we pick up this. God values human life, and he created us in his image. There's a value that he has over us because of his love for us and because each one of us bear his image. We also pick up that God crafts or forms the human being, and this forming takes place in the womb. We also learn through these passages that God has the knowledge of a person and even their future even before their birth. Overall, it's hard to walk away from these scriptures and many more that give us the impression that fetal life has deep meaning as God himself is involved in the process of bringing human persons to life. Fetal life has deep meaning. And these verses, which I just read for you, and ones like them, are at the heart of what we would call a pro-life ethic. Now, there's one other passage I feel like I need to address because it is mentioned often in the debate and it's very controversial. And just so you know that it's there and we need to deal with it, let me read it to you. Exodus 21:22, where this is part of the law that God handed down through Moses. It's part of the social law of the nation of Israel. Part of a section of the law that deals with compensation for personal injury. This is how you're supposed to compensate one another when someone's injured. God said to Moses, "If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there's no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there's serious injury, you're to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." Now, I got to say, stepping away from this issue of abortion, that whole thing is a little bit, it's hard to walk through that burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. But understand, this was part of a law that God was laying down for a just society in a society in that day, the tendency was to go way overboard and to overcompensate for injuries that were received at the hand of another. So God set these compensatory rules. But in regard to abortion here, what this passage seems to suggest is that the developing life within a woman is important enough that to bring it out forth sooner than it should demands some kind of reparation. If the child is brought out sooner than it should, somebody's got to pay for that. It's implied if the baby dies, you're to take life for life. The problem with this passage is that translation, those implications I just shared with you, are not accepted by all. By people, even those who would be strongly pro-life, they don't accept that translation, and it's somewhat confusing because the question is, does the injury that's related to in this passage relate to the child or to the woman? And it's very controversial. So the problem is we don't want to base our theology or ethic on something that is as controversial as that. But I bring it up because it's an important passage. The only point that I would say we can make legitimately from the passage is this. It seems to be, because even God brings it up, that there is a significant amount of value or status of an unborn child that would merit some kind of legal protection. I think that's pretty clear we can take from that passage. And it really points out, the philosophical question surrounding this whole thing. Because we can spend time talking about theology, but at the end of the day, we're going to come around to a philosophical discussion about this question. Just when is a person a person? When is a person become a person? That is a crucial question. Is abortion the killing of a biological being that belongs to the human species? Or is abortion the killing of a human person? Huge difference in the answers to those questions. Is abortion just the killing of a being that relates to the human species, or is that a human person? Now, I got to tell you, I got to apologize for what's going to come next. This is ridiculously oversimplified. For us to go into depth into this would take us hours and hours. So I apologize if this comes off as rather simplified, but let me share with you what I think are three general philosophies about personhood. When does a person become a person? And the answer to what you believe about this will go a long way to determining your ethic on this issue. There are generally three primary views of when a fetus becomes a person. View number one is called full personhood. And this is the maximum possible moral status that could be ascribed to a fetus. Personhood, in this view, is identified with biological life. It goes something like this. Pregnancy begins at conception, a time in which the male sperm and the female ovum unite. What results is called a zygote, a one-celled biological entity, a stage in human development through each one of us has to pass. We pass through that stage, and then we pass through infancy and childhood and adolescence. This would be one of the stages that we pass through. And there is no question, nobody would debate whether a zygote is biologically alive. Nobody debates that. Because it fulfills four criteria needed to establish biological life, which are metabolism, growth, reaction to stimuli, and reproduction. Those are all there within a zygote, which fulfills the criteria for it to be alive. But is it a human person? Those who believe in the full personhood view would say that this zygote is not just a human being, a biological entity, but a human person. And so the abortion of a zygote would be killing. Now, there are those who believe in a position called potential personhood. A potential person is an entity that will naturally and in due course develop into a person. A fetus, in this perspective, is a potential person, not an actual person. Those who hold to this view believe that there are some entities, some beings, that stand no chance of becoming a person. For example, a fetus that has no developing brain, or even, getting it out of the realm of the fetus, an irreversibly comatose patient. Those two are members of the human species. They're alive in a certain extent, but they have no potential for having the crucial aspects of the image of God. And those who hold to the potential personhood view would not be adverse to taking this life of a being that was not a person. They did not have the potential of developing full personhood. If I haven't lost you yet, let me go to the third. The third view is actual personhood. Those who hold to this view believe that the human personhood is defined by a number of specific functions that reflect not just consciousness, but self-reflective intelligence. Those who believe in the actual personhood view believe that embryos and fetuses lack personhood capacities. They are not able to engage in reflective intelligence yet. And so they are not an actual person. Those who hold to this view would also admit that people in persistent vegetative states or even the grossly retarded would not be actual persons. And here's a quote, "These lives deserve a measure of respect, but not the same status as fully human persons and should have fewer rights." There is even one proponent of this view that believes the minimum threshold of rationality is 85 on an IQ test. Again, another quote from a person who believes this: "If the right to life of the fetus is to be based upon its resemblance to a person, then it cannot be said to have any more right to life than, let us say, a newborn guppy. And a right of that magnitude could never override a woman's right to obtain an abortion at any stage of her pregnancy." So we have three views, and they're not just three views. There are probably 103 views. There are various gyrations and striations of each one of those views, from full personhood to potential personhood, to actual personhood. And where you come down on that philosophical spectrum will determine when you believe abortion is wrong or right. And I'm sorry, it's ridiculously simplistic, but you certainly can see and feel the tension of the debate when you see the differences of opinion. So I guess it's up to me now to tell you what we believe, or what I believe, right? What are we to decide based on the scriptures, the corollary scriptures about life and God, and this philosophical conundrum? I'm going to answer that with a question. And with this, you will know where I'm coming down. Why would we lean anyway but toward personhood at its earliest possible moment? Why would we lean anyway but toward personhood at its earliest possible moment? Can I look you in the eye and say definitively, I know that a zygote is a person? No. I don't think I could, because I'm not a scientist and I don't know that we have all the answers to all this. I don't know that I could look you in the eye and say, I know definitively that a zygote is a person. But here's my question. Why would we not err on the side of caution? I would rather be wrong in attributing too much personhood to a fetus than too little. You know why? Because the tendency in human history is to err the other way. The tendency in human history has been to err on the side of too much exclusion, with disastrous and cruel results. When we experience ethnic cleansing of all kinds worldwide, what you are experiencing, whether the people with the machete or the bomb are thinking this way or not, they are telling you there that the philosophy of life they've embraced is the actual personhood philosophy. What they're saying is the person I'm about to hack to death, the person I'm about to blow up, is not an actual person because they do not subscribe to my understanding of what a true person is. And that's the only way a person could go next door with a machete and take the life of a person who is their neighbor. You have to subscribe to that philosophy. This is the way humans are. What a horrible result of the fall. In the domain of the kingdom of God, there is no place for purposely taking the life of any human. As a result, erring on the side of caution, of life being far earlier than maybe we even know, the abortion of a fetus is wrong. And we, the church, must respond appropriately to protect the lives of innocent children along with the women and men who face unwanted pregnancies. It's our responsibility. Protect the lives of the babies, and at the same time, with the same rigor and with the same energy and with the same compassion, protect the lives and move into the lives of men and women who are faced with this horrific decision. Now, in a moment, I want to get some practical suggestions. Before I do, I'm going to take you on a very controversial side trip. I can almost guarantee you that some of the things I'm about to say, you may not embrace as something you believe. So I'm just telling you ahead of time. While we face abortion, we must also face some other issues that would lead us to what some have called a consistent ethic of life. If we have strong beliefs about abortion, we must also decide what we believe about bioethics. Now, when I talk about bioethics, I'm talking about things like genetic manipulation or cloning and manipulating the DNA, stem cell research, and reproductive technology, in vitro fertilization. Let me just say a couple comments here. If we're going to err on the side of life beginning earlier, not later, and that human personhood begins earlier, not later, then we've got to be careful almost to the point of paranoia about what we do with that human person, knowing that God has formed that human person in the womb. I'm not going to make a definitive statement about genetic manipulation, but we as a church had better start to be prepared about what is facing us in some of the decisions that are coming down the road, and we've got to take great care. Stem cell research. I know this is hugely controversial. There are people that believe, and I believe it too, that with more research with the stem cells, that possibly we could see unbelievable breakthroughs that would make paralyzed people walk and obliterate some illnesses. I know that's true, but at the same time, again, I ask you, if we're going to err on the side of personhood beginning earlier, not later, then friends, we have to err on the side of protecting those unborn persons and emphasize stem cell research that does not include the kind of material that comes from aborted fetuses. And finally, the most controversial of the things I'm going to say regarding reproductive technology. And this is controversial because so many of you who are unable to have children have the wonder and the awe of resorting to great science that would have allowed you to have a child. And I've had discussions with people about this. People have asked me, what should we do? Let me explain for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about what happens. In some in vitro fertilization that happens outside the womb, the sperm and the egg are united in the glass. They're united together and a zygote is formed. Now at that moment, if we err towards life at earlier, not later, you understand the dilemma that a couple faces. When the doctor says to them, we recommend that we fertilize 7 to 9 eggs and implant a number of them because not all implantations are effective. And so what ends up happening is implantation of fertilized eggs, some of which are spontaneously aborted because physically it doesn't work. And usually a couple is left with eggs that they've got to make a decision what they're going to do with. And I've talked to people who have said, what do I do with the 7 eggs that we have left over? I want to be incredibly sensitive to you because I know the desire to have children, and I'm not telling you not to do in vitro fertilization. Don't hear me when I say that. Or resort to reproductive technology. I think it's a wonder and it's an amazing what has happened. But please be careful as you pursue that route. So the ramifications that could occur with the decision you have to make. Euthanasia is another one. Mercy killing is another issue we have to be aware of. Penny's mom was dying of a horrible cancer. Penny and I have talked about this frequently since she died a number of years ago. Her mom was barely over 60. Her cancer took her life down to nothing. Looking at her on the bed and watching her die was a horrific situation. And Penny and I have talked about, for the first time, we understood mercy killing. We understood it. We totally got it. It wasn't just theoretical for us, it was actual. I have to tell you that even today, Penny and I believe that even though it would have been wonderful to send her mother home to glory, because here's this missionary lady, we know she, when she dies, she's going to be in the arms of Jesus, and wouldn't it be better than the state she's in right now in this bed? I have to tell you, we need to err on the side of life, even as painful as it is. I'm not giving you specifics. I don't know what that looks like when your loved one is laying on that bed, but I have to tell you, prayerfully consider erring on the side of life. And finally, maybe, I don't know if this is more controversy or less, capital punishment. This is where we're probably going to part ways, some of you and me. And I'll tell you that because I do not believe in capital punishment. I do not support it. And the reason why I personally do not support it is because it is not commensurate with the consistent ethic of life. If a human being at the very early stage is a human person, then that's a human person until the day they die. A human person that possesses the image of God. And in every case, we must err towards a highest value on life and assume that God's image is embedded in every human person. His hopes and his dreams define every human person. And that God is actively at work in every human person despite how tragic that person's life. The task of the church is to hold out for the sacredness of life and to participate in gracious, transforming acts that reduce life being taken, especially crisis pregnancies. And so I want to wrap this up by just briefly covering, I think, some practical acts of life that we need to give our lives to. Acts of life that this church must involve in, first of all, we must care for the marginalized and vulnerable. We must stand against the oppression of women and minorities, which perpetuates the tragic circumstances that lead to abortion. We must house and care for women who are caught in this tragedy. Related to that, we must be committed to social justice, finding ways for health care and nutrition and jobs to come to people who find themselves in these situations, and even heading off these situations, which some of them are bred by the lack of justice. We must be a people who are committed to adoption and adoption reform to make adoption easier and healthier for children. We must be committed to foster care. We absolutely must stand for healthy sexual ethics. We have to. And we've got to move into our world with authentic, loving relationships. And finally, more than anything else, we must continue to love people to Jesus. Because he's the one, he's the healer, he's the transformer. We must continue to be a redemptive community for those pre-abortion choice and those post-abortion choice. For those who've endured the agony and the terror of post-abortion pain, because so many people still struggle with the agony of a post-abortive life. We want to bring this down to a point to offer you some opportunities for healing and some compassion because your life has been hell.